Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. Well, we are just days away from the much-touted winter solstice, December 21st. Will it be much ado about nothing, like Y2K, or will there really be some shift in consciousness that we can see and feel? Myself, I'm keeping an open mind and a hopeful heart. I've been told we will get what we expect in the coming year, so be very careful what you think, because our thoughts can manifest into reality. If we live in a fear-based mindset of scarcity, that might be just what we get. So I prefer to see the world opening like a beautiful lotus flower, opening to more freedom, possibilities for women, shedding light on the oppressors and the dominators of the world, so we can reject their patriarchal power over mindsets. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and I'm the author of the two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, sold in all the usual places, and of course you can get a specially signed copy direct from me. And my other book, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, which won an award in the spirituality category in the USA National Best Books. It tells a person or group how to live a goddess-inspired life. It's divided into the four elements and spirit, the earth, section tells you about our adventures going to sacred places around the world. The water section is about love and doing ritual. Fire is about politics and passion. The air section is about those whispers of inspiration we get from goddess. And spirit, well, that's about how a girl like me from the Bible Belt of New Orleans can get the calling from the sacred feminine and take her life down a path she sure never expected. And then Sacred Places of Goddess, well, that tells you about the diversity of goddess and her spirituality, past and living today across continents and cultures. Check them both out on my website, and I have a special online offer of both books for $25 if you live in the U.S. Well, it seems the last couple shows I have been having difficulty getting the music to start, and I am really sorry for that tonight because I was going to play some of Diva Haley's music from her Sacred Alchemy CD, and I think I'll try to squeeze that in later on and see if I can get it to work. But tonight I have an exciting show jam-packed with provocative talk. At the top of the hour, Jeanette Clancy talks to us about the consequences and immorality of sexist god talk that leads to sex trafficking, female slavery, female genital mutilation, misogyny in the church, and why change toward women's equality moves at such a glacial pace among church fathers. Then, after crossing the threshold into the second half of the show, author Greg Kreisberg is calling in to discuss mysteries of the ancient past, exploring the evolution of human consciousness, civilization, and technology, including how contemporary discoveries are aligning with ancient wisdom, how higher consciousness may explain many mysteries of our ancient past, why there's a resurgence of elemental shamanism in the 21st century, why ancient pre-literate man was so obsessed with tracking the precession of the equinox, and much more, including the common themes and symbols of ancient mythology that reveal an esoteric or pagan link with Christian and Judean beliefs. But first,
most people see humankind is really separate from nature and separate from the earth. I'm as much of this earth as a rock or a tree is. And I came out of it. This is my mother planet. I grew out of this earth.
As long as we conceive of divinity as above us or outside of us, or that our bodies are somehow less divine than spirit, there's no way that we can change our course.
Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, those erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, well, that's the rolling grass, hills, and meadows, strength of her spine, look to those mountains, tall backs, Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. Well, those are just some of the opening words from Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia is a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality and about connecting to the earth and ways to do just that. It gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and the spirit of the earth and the mother all around you. It's also visually stunning. The DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet, and it's only $20, and you can get it from dancingwithgaia.com. I've actually seen the DVD, listeners, and honestly, it's a great way to learn about connecting with the landscape of the goddess, both internally and externally. And if you're still looking for holiday gifts, you might want to think about that. I don't think you'd be disappointed. I also have a few important shout-outs tonight. My two friends, Christy and Marcia, are having birthdays in the next few days. My mom, too. So happy birthday, Christy, Marcia, Mom. May Goddess grant you all you wish for in the coming year. And my thanks goes out to Molly Reamer for her generous contribution to help keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air. Thank you, Molly, from the bottom of my heart. Molly wrote in and she said, "Please keep on. Your show is definitely needed in making a difference. I live here in the Midwest, Rolla, Missouri, right in the Bible Belt." I know how that is, Molly. I came from the Bible Belt, too. Well, Molly says, "I actually have a vision of starting a goddess temple of the Ozarks. Your show helps me connect to the wider world of goddess spirituality and to bring it to my community. I'm an ordained priestess, and I facilitate quarterly women's rituals as well as various other celebrations focused on women's mysteries and rites of passage." She just recently presided over a wedding ceremony in her red, red Midwestern state and joyously represented the goddess and her ideals. Well, you go, Molly. It's people like you carrying the goddess torch into the future. And I also heard from Donna. Donna says, "Thank you once again for reaching out to a listener of your radio show and answering my questions. The beautiful chant of Sekhmet that you played on your show, I've shared with other devotees of hers. Its artist gave a beautiful tribute to Sekhmet. And Karen, you affect so many women with knowledge of the goddess and teachers who can help your listeners with their books and firsthand accounts of their love for our beloved goddess. Keep inspiring the thousands of us who do not have a strong community or place of worship or a shrine in which to give her praise. May the coming winter solstice bring us all renewed hope." That's from Donna Swindells with the Iseum of Hathor, Lady of the West. Thank you, ladies, from the bottom of my heart. As I always say, it's messages like yours that are gas in my tank. And we know how precious and valuable motivation and appreciation are, don't we? So please share it widely with those you love. Make sure they know that you are grateful and they are appreciated. Well, I'm going to let you hear the bees buzzing around in my bonnet. Well, first, the bees buzzing around in my bonnet, or for Judge Derek Johnson of Orange County. Meet this California judge. Remember that name, Derek Johnson in Orange County, that's in Southern California, who claimed that a rape victim didn't put up a fight. This comes from Amanda Marcotte, writing for Slate.com. She says, "First there was Todd Aiken, and now this, a judge in California who was finally being admonished by the California Commission on Judicial Performance for his 2008 comments justifying giving a light sentence to a man who beat his girlfriend with a metal baton, threatened to mutilate her face and genitals with a heated screwdriver, and then viciously raped her. The offending quote really needs to be read in full for maximum jaw-dropping effect. He says, the judge, "I'm not a gynecologist, but I can tell you something. If someone doesn't want to have sexual intercourse, the body shuts down. The body will not permit that to happen unless a lot of damage is inflicted. And we heard nothing about that in this case. That tells me that the victim in this case, although she wasn't necessarily willing, well, she didn't put up a fight. And to treat this case like the rape cases that we all hear about is an insult to victims of rape. I think it's an insult. I think it trivializes a rape." Well, Amanda with Salon.com goes on to say about this judge, Derek Johnson, "I wanted to give Judge Derek Johnson the benefit of the doubt. After all, his primary concern is not trivializing rape, but he appears to believe vaginas have some sort of snapping mechanism, and the only way that a rapist can really rape you is by breaking the hinges, which doesn't explain why he thinks having someone tell you to open your snapper or else he'll break your vulva's hinges doesn't count as rape. If someone points a gun at a store clerk and tells him to open the cash drawer else, it's still a robbery, even if the register does, in fact, have a sealing mechanism designed to keep intruders out. Oh, and what was Johnson's job before he became a judge? Well, he worked for the Orange County District Attorney's Sex Crimes Unit. Comforting, isn't it? And he's still on the bench. Yes, this guy only got an admonishment. What a shame. Seriously, we have a problem of a violent culture, a culture of misogyny that's like the elephant in the living room, not talked about enough. But we will talk about that with our first guest, Jeanette, just after this last thing I want to share, this last bee buzzing round in my bonnet tonight. It's from a leader of the New Haven Peace Council in Connecticut, where those 20 children were just gunned down in our culture, where so many are more worried about keeping their machine guns and rifles because of their fear-based Glenn Beck end-of-world scenarios that dance around in their head, where they think they're going to have to face off against the government someday. Yeah, right. We're going to face off against the government with their rifles while the government has tanks and drones. Please, give me a break. It doesn't even make sense. Anyway, here are the words of Henry Lowendorf. He says, "There's no pain like the loss of a child. The tragedy that overtook Newton suddenly dropped that pain on too many to count and left heart sickness in its wake. The children and the adults who tried to protect them have become waves of memories crashing inside us. Our thoughts and prayers go to those closely devastated with grief, a grief even shared around the world. As we collectively try to bear the unbearable, as we pick ourselves up to live on, to cope, and to look for means to prevent such future tragedies, we must not be nearsighted in investigating the causes. This is not the first case of a mass killing in our schools. It's not the sole case of mass killing of children, for in nearby New Haven and Hartford, that many children are shot and killed on the streets throughout every year. Because their lives are not taken in a short span of time, public attention is limited, directed elsewhere, and the shock and sorrow do not circle very far. Because they are mostly children of color, for many in the majority white population, they are someone else's children." Do we pause even for a moment when we read? Do we even read stories of Afghan children, Iraqi children, Palestinian children, Congolese children, thousands of whose lives are brutally taken in lands battered by war? They are so far away. Why are these other children deserving less of our concern? Are they really related to our current tragedy? What we witness at this moment are the effects of a brief war zone, one regrettably close to home. Let us remember a similarly painful tragedy in 2001 on September 11th. Inexcusably, it did not lead to introspection about the cause and thoughtful efforts aimed at addressing and removing it. Rather, what ensued was a violent reaction named shock and awe, whose erroneous goals led to the death of thousands, tens of thousands of Afghans, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, mostly non-combatants, little children whose lives were totally disconnected with 9/11, and thousands of our own precious children in avoidable wars. Those lucky enough to survive have been traumatized for life. It's not enough to question the availability of guns and gun ownership policies in the United States, for we live in an economy of violence that goes far beyond handguns. Our nation spends over $1 trillion a year on building killing machines and actively using them more than all other countries combined. Our nation maintains an arsenal of nuclear weapons that can instantaneously end the lives of all children and all civilization. Our nation recruits our youth, who we parents have taught to cherish life, and teaches them to kill. Our nation buys billions of dollars of weaponry and sells millions worth of armaments at home and abroad, sales that will fill the coffers of the manufacturers of killing machines, sales that bind us to the unnecessary premature deaths of our global brothers and sisters. Yes, we live in a culture of violence. On Independence Day 1852, Frederick Douglass called out the great shocking and bloody violence of our nation. Martin Luther King Jr., 45 years ago, a year before being assassinated, spoke and said, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. We must address the shocking and bloody tragedy in Newton and so many other tragedies like it as the result of spiritual death. We must aim a keen eye to reach spiritual uplift. For only if we accept the responsibility to look beyond the heart of a grieving nation and seek out a fundamental flaw, only as we are willing to seek a higher truth and not root out the culture of violence and an economy that feeds on it, will we have reason to expect to see all of our children here and there live long and happy lives as it should be, only then. In sorrow, peace, and justice, that's Henry Lowendorf, Greater New Haven Peace Council. Well, what I'd like to add to that is, first, I think let's let it sink in a minute, and I want to repeat Martin Luther King Jr.'s quote. He said, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. I can only hope these children did not lose their lives in vain in Newton, that their deaths will usher in some sanity in the world." But yet, before I even started my show, we're listening to discussion about the fiscal cliff, and what is it Republicans want to cut? They want to cut food for children. They want to cut tax credits. They want to cut education to give the rich even more tax breaks, and not a word about cutting the defense budget. But I want to make another point. It's about class in our country and how we respond to class. Hurricane Sandy came in early November before the election. It was devastating, yes, and people have responded in incredible ways from all over the country, as rightly they should. But as a native of New Orleans, I think I see a difference between how the country and government has rallied to the aid of New York and New Jersey and how it's been different than how it responded to the Gulf Coast, New Orleans, and Katrina. Is it just that we had a pitiful Republican president in George Bush and his inept cronies after Katrina? Or was it something more? Did the country not go all out to rebuild New Orleans because it isn't rebuilt, like they're promising to do in New York and New Jersey because New Orleans was poorer and blacker? And what about this killing spree in Connecticut, very white and affluent Connecticut? The gunman's mother, I read, got over $200,000 a year in child support and alimony. Most people I know make that in 4 years, not one. We don't pay attention to the brown and black-skinned kids killed every day, as Henry Lowendorf brings to the fore. But we are paying attention in Connecticut. Does race and class make a difference in who we value in this society? I'm just asking. Okay, well, I want to thank Jeanette for her patience, and I want to say hi, Jeanette. Welcome to the show.
I have to get my voice after listening so long. Okay, hi. Hi.
Hi, Jeanette. I want to read your bio and get my my listeners up to speed, because it's been a little while since you've been on the show with me.
Right.
So, listeners, Jeanette Clancy is an educator and a writer living in the small town of Avon, Minnesota. Besides writing, she's a great blogger. I often post her blog posts on my Facebook page. Her blog is godisnot3guys.com, and the three is the number three. She supervises teacher candidates for university. She was brought up a Catholic. She still lives in a culture that's mostly Catholic, and she got a master's degree in theology. But she dissents from Catholic teaching in her writing, and she belongs to a community that plans woman priest liturgies. Besides writing books, she has written for many periodicals, including Letters in the National Catholic Reporter. Frequently, she appears on opinion pages writing about religion and other topics related to these sorts of things. And I always like to go to Jeanette because she's one of the progressive Christians that I know who I can always count on to have a sane head. And tonight we're going to talk about one of her blogs that she recently had posted, and the show topic is related to that. It's the consequences of sexist God talk. So, Jeanette, why do you say it's sexist?
Oh, my. It's all about a male God. God is he, him, his, and Father and Lord and Master and King. And, you know, it's just male nouns and male pronouns. The pronouns are worse than the nouns, I think, because pronouns work on the unconscious level so that people don't even know what's happening to them. They just assume that he is superior to she, and male power is made to seem, I always say this, male power seems natural, normal, proper, and right, and female power seems unnatural, improper, abnormal, and wrong. And that's why any female who exercises some power is looked at with suspicion. Any woman who talks back is called a bitch. And a man who shows that kind of strength is admired. It's on an unconscious level, our society, every society really on earth, expects that women should be quiet and subdued and give in and reserved. And males should be dominant and throw their weight around, and it's perfectly okay for males to throw their weight around, but not for females. And that comes from language.
Well, and also, too, is it any wonder when Christianity has left women with the role model of Mary, you know, all her wonderful attributes we will acknowledge, but, you know, she's a nice, passive lady who doesn't cause any trouble, and she's quiet and kind of stays in the background and doesn't give anybody any trouble, like a Kali or a Sekhmet or a Morrigan.
But the Catholic Church made darn sure that Mary could not rise to divinity. We were taught that repeatedly. We were told, in no uncertain terms, Mary is not God. God has to be he, him, his. We're not told that last sentence. We're not told that God has to be him, his. That's just how we always hear it. But God is different from Mary. Mary is not God. Emphatically, we learn that. And so it's impossible to have a female or a feminine image of the divinity in the Catholic Church. It's the language that does it, because the language, and theologians, the Pope knows better. Theologians, anybody who studies theology, even on a very elemental level, knows that God is no more male than female. But the Vatican makes sure that the language must not change. I really give theological ladder, the language of the liturgy, you know, for Catholics it's a mass, and for Protestants it's all of their services. It's all the God talk. Every reference to God is male, and that is the reason that women are kept down. It plays a much, much larger role than people imagine.
So, Jeanette, all right. I mean, obviously, you know, we're not living in the dark ages. We can't say people are illiterate anymore. That maybe we can say they're ignorant, but people who rise to the level of Pope aren't ignorant. What's the agenda? How can they possibly justify this sexism, this discrimination? I mean, they can't really believe this stuff. So.
No, they don't, and they don't just. They simply don't talk about why they can do it. They don't justify it. They just do it. For instance, for 17 years, there was a commission, an international commission on English language, and this developed after Vatican II. And this, and it's short for ICEL, International Commission on English Language. It was supposed to come up with liturgical language for all of, you know, all the English services around the world. So this includes India and Australia, and, you know. And they finished their work. Their liturgical language was accepted by every bishop's commission confraternity in the world. So it was given to the Vatican, and everybody expected just an automatic approval, and then it would be implemented. the Vatican didn't approve. Finally, the Vatican put out an ill-crafted, awkward, funny, weird liturgical change. And so we have had changes in the Mass language, and people, it's hard, I don't have the notes in front of me. I've written a lot about that, too. But that's an indication of how the Vatican simply gives rules, and it imposed this translation on the whole English-speaking world, around the world. Everybody has to change this language. It's even more sexist and male-centered than the previous translation. And the Vatican does not justify doing this. It just does it. What really annoys me is that the whole, I was hoping when I heard that this was going to happen, I was hoping that, oh, for instance, large monasteries, I live next to large monasteries, one of the largest women's Benedictine monasteries in the world, one of the largest men's monasteries in the world. And I was hoping that groups like that and bishops around the world and the so-called faithful would just rebel. But instead, they just obsequiously complied with this. And now, you know, everybody can say it worked. The bishops are just relieved. Oh, it worked. People didn't rebel. But it's so annoying. You see, as I was listening to you earlier, Karen, I realized again how different your world is from mine. I live, as you said in my, you know, Jeanette Blondigan Clancy lives in a Catholic country. This is, everybody around me is Catholic or Christian. And, not everybody, of course. There are atheists. I have atheist friends, but it's almost dangerous for them. They don't dare proclaim their atheism. And it would be even worse for someone to say that she prays to the goddess. That would meet greater derision and scorn than announcing that a person is atheist.
But
so
yeah.
But
I mean, Jeanette, I know the hypocrisy or the immorality or the criminal mm-hmm. aspect of this cannot be lost on you, you know, because you know we're talking about this sexism, this misogyny, you know,
yeah.
has led to all manner of pain for women, you know, sex trafficking,
right.
female genital mutilation,
exactly.
domestic violence,
yeah.
and you know all of these.
And why do they not see it? Right? That's
yeah. Well, they have to see it. They must know it. So is it they hate
they
women so badly? I mean, or do they fear women
they
so badly? Because
they
you know, I'm tired of hearing people say, you know what, this is just the last gasps of patriarchy. It's going to all go away. You know what? What if it doesn't without, you know, more people standing up against this immorality?
Well, actually, you know, I do have hope because even in my area, when I started writing, when I first had the idea of writing my book, well, let me go back. In the 1980s, I was at the School of Theology, and that's when the term, the phrase came to me, God is not three guys in the sky. And I remember thinking, you know, that really is the title of a book. So I was thinking about writing a book way back then, and I thought that I would have to maybe, I didn't know what to do. I seriously envisioned myself being shot for saying what I had to say. And I was that afraid in the 1980s. Well, my book didn't come out. That's a long story about why it didn't. It didn't come out until 2007. And by that time, I have received just positive responses. You know, there are people here and there that I hear about. But I was amazed at how many people were ready to get this message that God is not three guys in the sky. It's it made a huge difference that it came, well, just 20 years later.
Well, and your point being that things have changed that much in that frame of a period of time.
Right, and continue to change. And the pace of change is quickening. I'm surprised. Well, for instance, I have many Benedictine sister friends, and, you know, while the community, the Benedictine community as a whole, can't come out and agree with you and me, individually, many of them get it. They really get it. I'm sort of in the middle. I have a leg on both sides of the fence. You know, when I listen to you and all of the other women who talk about the goddess, you know, I'm right with you, and I still know how to use Christian language. Well, it's that's a challenge to talk in Christian terms. Oh my, there's so much to say about that. But you know, I, what I'm saying is I have one foot in that field too.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do is help Christians to broaden their base of knowledge, to broaden the consciousness of Christians. And I think I know it's happening. From listening to media reports, you know, Christians are opening their minds. Unfortunately, though, among Catholics, those who really, really get it just leave. They don't stay in the church to change the church. Mostly they just leave. But the sisters, the friends who are the sister friends I have, stay with the community because they are very loyal to their community of women, you see.
Well, also, too, I mean, look, the reality probably is also economic, isn't it? I mean, I was thinking about Father Roy Bourgeois recently, who was finally excommunicated from the Mary Knowles for supporting women's ordination. And, you know, this man is probably in his 60s, I'm guessing. He's been in the church all of his life. Now he's been booted out. He has nothing.
I know. Well, I was assured by a friend of his, a priest friend of his, said, I was talking about that very thing, about how risky it is for anybody to tell the truth that they know. And this priest friend said that the Mary Knowlers really are making sure that he's not penniless. And that makes me feel so good. You know, they have to put on this public face of guapo and the. Have you heard the latest?
I don't think I must not have by the tone of your voice. Go ahead. What's the latest?
You know, for more than a year, we were wondering, will Mary Knoll expel him from the community? Because we knew that that's what the Vatican wanted. And for a while, we thought that Mary Knoll had, in fact, struck him from their roles, that he was no longer allowed to be a Mary Knoll priest. And then we heard, no, they had not decided to do that. And we didn't really know what was going on. It was all, well, then, about, I don't know, a month or 2 months ago, all of a sudden the Vatican decides to expel him from the Mary Knoll community.
Can they do that?
And the former head of the Mary Knoll Fathers said that this was unwarranted, and that the Vatican was I forget the term he used, but it was essentially butting its head into where it didn't belong. And so I was really happy about that response. But he has been officially taken off the roles of the Mary Knoll priest.
Well, and I mean, and remember what the church did too. recently in this that whole contraception debacle, those bishops telling women what to do with their bodies, and being mad at the nuns because the nuns weren't touting the party line strong enough. You know,
and the bishops didn't like the fact that the nuns were helping the poor more than they were railing against gays.
It's unbelievable. Well, you know, therein lies a perfect example of male patriarchy versus the sacred feminine wisdom. Don't you think?
Right. Exactly. That's why I'm laughing. You know, when some of these most outrageous acts are perpetrated, I just laugh because I have to tell you the truth. I'm kind of glad that they do such crazy things because they are discrediting themselves so publicly.
Yes. I mean, well, that's what I've thought. You know, I've thought, you know what, they keep this up and they're going to become less and less relevant.
Exactly.
But I mean, what do you think about, you know, this jerk Bill O'Reilly on Fox News? They're always whining about the war on Christmas. I mean, Jeanette, from where I sit, it's always the Christians that are trying to oppress somebody else. No, but, you know, how are they being oppressed?
Is Bill O'Reilly saying that again?
Yes. Every year it's the same thing.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. I don't know anybody who believes it. I really don't. Even in this very Christian place that I live in, people have given up. Well, now this year I haven't read a single thing about it. Other years, people would write letters to the editor, you know, in the local paper and all that, and I've written about it and said how ridiculous that was. And I think most people have caught on to the fact that it's just a non-issue. It's just something, you know, made up by the conservatives.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're good at that. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I hate to conservative bash, but I'm just so done with them all. You know, they're always, you know, making up problems that don't exist.
Yeah.
And they don't deal with reality. And consequently, you know, they hold everybody back from progressing to a higher state of consciousness.
Right. Conservatism used to be an honorable thing. And there still are. I can name some conservative Republicans, for instance, that for whom I have great respect. One is, I'll say the first name that comes to mind because I just recently read about him in the paper, and that's Chuck Hagel, who might be the next Secretary of Defense. I hope so. He's a Republican, and he spoke out against the insanity of the Iraq War. Who's the other? Dick Lugar. He's another honorable Republican, conservative. You know, I might not agree with them on economic matters, but I respect them.
Mm-hmm.
And there has been, you know, a whole slew of such conservatives. The Republican Party used to be an honorable party.
Well, and they're
now,
going after Hagel. I mean, you probably heard they're going after Hagel.
Who is Republican?
The Republicans. Yeah, they're going after him. Let's talk a little bit about Half the Sky. Half the Sky is that book, in case my listeners don't recognize the title, by Nicholas Kristof and his wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn. And it's about, bringing opportunity and empowerment to women around the world. Talk about that, Jeanette, as it relates to this, you know, this sexist God talk topic we have tonight.
Yeah, I think that it's the overlord God image that contributes to the fact that, and this is not only in Christianity, it's around the world, God being considered male contributes to females being misused, abused around the world, bride beating, bride burning, genital cutting, forced prostitution, rape as a tactic of war, acid to disfigure, selling 7- and 8-year-old girls into sexual slavery, all of this. When I was reading their book, Half the Sky, here are some facts that really got down to me. A Nobel laureate economist estimates that the globe should have 107 million more women than it has. In other words, with the birth rates as they are, we should have 107 more million on the globe. They're gone. Why do they disappear? Because women are murdered, female babies are murdered, and baby girls are deliberately fed less and cared for less than baby boys.
Well, I mean, we know China has a problem. They don't even have enough women to marry all the men.
Exactly, and they're going to understand what they've done to themselves increasingly as the years progress, because they'll realize more and more that they need more women, just because men are going to become, men are not happy without women.
Right,
So they're looking at a huge problem. Here's another fact. A third of all women worldwide face beatings in the home. Women aged 15 through 44 are more likely to be maimed or die from male violence than from cancer, malaria, traffic accidents, and war combined. I'm taking these things right from the book. I wrote them down because they just they made such an impression on me. And here's another one. Far more women and girls are shipped into brothels each year in the early 21st century than African slaves were shipped into slave plantations each year in the 18th or 19th centuries.
Wow.
Foreign affairs observed, it seems almost certain that the modern global slave trade is larger in absolute terms than the Atlantic slave trade in the 18th or 19th centuries was.
And, you know, people can say, oh, well, this isn't happening in the United States, but it is.
Oh, it is.
I mean, I've had people on the show talking about this that goes on in the United States. And if you listen to my show regularly, you know I always am bringing to the fore the insanity of the Republican Party. But it's relevant because, I mean, they mm-hmm. you know, especially in the last few years, they
yeah.
vote against everything that's for women. You know, they voted against a recent thing that used to have support from both sides, you know, protecting women from domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
They can't even do that.
And that didn't used to be the case in the Republican Party. The party has been taken over by extremists, and it is not the party of old. It's not an honorable party anymore. Here's something that I haven't mentioned yet about the God image in our sexist God talk. It's not only that God is always male, it's that God is always a dominator. And the hierarchy of the Catholic Church endorses hierarchy and domination as the essential structure of the universe. They teach us by example and also explicitly that this is the way everything has to be. There always has to be superior and inferior. Every relationship has a superior and an inferior. And so this deforms all the relationships on the globe.
Right.
Of humans with each other, of humans with nature, of humans with animals. It's all deformed, and as you were saying in the introduction, I just love the very first part of your introduction when you were talking about God being inside instead of God being an overlord dominating over things, and this is what the hierarchy of the Catholic Church does.
Well, there's a great documentary out that shows the connection between colonialism, capitalism, and Christianity, how those three things together have merged and morphed to create the incredible oppression and inequality across the globe.
Right.
I mean, really, you know, religion is supposed to be about love, and it's supposed to be uplifting.
Mm-hmm.
And really,
mm-hmm.
it's a sledgehammer.
That's right, yeah. And Jesus of Nazareth did not teach that at all. That has
right.
nothing to do with the Nazarenes preaching. With what the message that he was trying to get across was simply what we call the reign of God. it was what I call the reign of God. Church language is kingdom, you know, which is actually a misnomer. I read a book by somebody who knows Aramaic, which is the language of Jesus of Nazareth, you know. And in Aramaic, this writer says that, let me see, I'm not going to think of his name. Anyway, he says that it would be, considering the culture and the mindset and the language of Jesus Aramaic, it would be more correct, more accurate to call it the queendom of heaven.
Wow. Well, yeah. I've always said Jesus was one of the first feminists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, that's not absolutely accurate, but yes, Jesus was, you know, he interacted with women. He depended on women economically.
Well, and also, too, it seems like to me he wanted to promote more of the values that, you know, the caring, the sharing, you know, phrase of
our
his, you know,
values.
A camel, you know, about rich men and the camel going through the eye of the needle thing, you know, turning over the tables of the money changers in the temple. You know, and there too, you know, it just reminds me of the hypocrisy of, you know, of so many Christians, you know, who totally ignore that message of Jesus.
Right. Yeah. It has nothing to.
Well, now talk a little bit about how Christian God talk actually violates the Judeo-Christian theology.
Oh, thanks for it violates the first commandment because. Now, I'm going to quote Maxine Moe Rasmussen, a friend of mine, whom I hope you will interview soon.
Yeah, she is going to be on the show, I think, in January.
Good. She and I both talk about the first commandment prohibits idolatry. It prohibits idolizing an image instead of what God is, which is ineffable and unimaginable. And what the God, sexist God talk, always father and son, it makes them into male idols. And Maxine says, if you must use only male terms. So this is the way it happened. She'd be talking to people about how that, you know, we should use female terms in reference to God and people would say, oh, no, I have to use God, he, and, you know, I have to say Father. I can't think of God any other way. So she says, if you must use only male terms while speaking of God, not choose to, but must use only male names, you have created and are worshiping an idol. And
very,
that's the way it is. Yeah.
Very astute.
It's an idol.
That's a good point.
It's an external being outside of us. An
right.
object, an idol.
Well, and what about the Trinitarian theology too?
Yes, it's actually a violation of Trinitarian theology. The greatest Trinitarian theologians that are and they're the ones who really formulated the theology of Trinity back in the 4th century and are still considered the masters of that theology. They were Cappadocians. Cappadocia is an area in today's Turkey. Basil and Gregory the Great and Gregory of Nyssa. Well, Gregory of Nyssa wrote, no one can adequately grasp the terms pertaining to God. For example, mother is mentioned in place of father. Both terms mean the same. Because the divine is neither male nor female. For how could such a thing be contemplated in the divinity when it does not remain intact permanently for us human beings either?
So, Jeanette, do you think if you were a fly on the wall or could go back in your time machine, when things sort of got, you know, I mean, as feminist theologists believe that, you know, there was a time women were equal or maybe even revered because of their association to Goddess, when things shifted and patriarchy takes over, do you think it was really – little more than a petty power grab that they made look good by slapping a religious label on it, by slapping, you know, this idea that God said it to justify it?
That's such a question. Oh, my goodness. I should send you sometime what I wrote for the book. I wrote one of the essays. There's an anthology called The Rule of Mars, readings on the origins, history, and something of patriarchy.
Yeah, Christina Biaggi was actually on the show. She mentioned that book.
And I talked about that, you know, where does patriarchy come from? I think we don't know. Anthropologists have several theories about it. And I think it was economic as well as just males being jealous. I don't know how it could get started. Females evidently cooperated with it.
Right, right.
And still do today, of course.
If we believe that, you know, some of these egalitarian societies were not equipped to fight off invaders, then you know, it was a matter of just they would, you know, dominate or die. I mean, we know the pagan temples were closed under penalty of death.
And you know about the work of archaeologist Maria Gimbutas, I'm sure.
Right, right.
Right, and she says that there were these invasions, and patriarchy was happening the Old Testament shows. Oh, that would be another topic to talk about sometime. The goddess in the Bible. We can see from delving into the linguistic analysis of the Old Testament language, and I wish I knew Hebrew, but I have to depend on experts for this. Linguistic analysis shows that goddess worship existed among the Hebrews or the Israelites, you know, the forerunners of today's Jews.
Right.
And goddess language is, we see the vestiges of it.
Yes, yes. Yeah, Yahweh had a wife.
her
name was Asherah.
Yeah, that's right. Yahweh had a wife. Uh-huh.
So now, we could say, okay, so, you know, so these religions, you know, don't want to, you know, give up their God talk. But what people have to realize, this is like a domino effect. It affects mm-hmm. us in not getting equal pay. It affects us in being underrepresented in corporate America, in politics, in academia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has far-reaching effects beyond the church.
Right. You know, I was going to talk about a study. Let's see, I don't think it's a book, but it's a study put out by Jennifer Lawless and Richard Fox, professors at universities in Washington, D.C., and they talk about the continued underrepresentation of women in U.S. politics. They have given an analysis that's pretty interesting. I would think, you know, thinking about that topic, I think I know everything about it, but some of the things that they say are surprising. They said that women are much less likely than men. Yes, this has come out in the rest of the media too. Women are less likely than men to think they are qualified to run for office. We are afraid that we're not good enough.
Well, we've been brainwashed.
We've been
diminished and marginalized and brainwashed. And if you've, you know,
we
if you've been told you're second class citizen for hundreds of years, or you know, then how can you just step into that role easily? You know, so women have to step up and grab that mantle of leadership, not just expect men to hand it to us.
And we have to believe in ourselves. We have to develop confidence. I've spent a lifetime trying to develop it in myself, and I think I'll die still working on it. It's just that it's a lifetime effort,
It's something that all of us, as and I find myself finding it easy. I find it easy to tell other women to think well of themselves, and then I catch myself putting myself down. You know, I think all of us are. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, we all do that. We have to keep, let's not forget, there are, women who play into the patriarchal paradigm, so they're complicit in their own oppression, and they sort of, help keep feeding this thing. I mean, just like the aunties and the grandmas who go pull their 8-year-old daughter, grandchildren or nieces, into the tent for vaginal mutilation, there's some women who just keep hold women back, we're not just fighting the patriarchy mindset of some men, but also the patriarchal mindset of, women as well.
Exactly.
I want to say something. Go right ahead.
Okay, there was something that I hadn't mentioned in Trinitarian theology. I want to repeat a point that you and I made earlier, that theologians do know better. The Pope knows better. God, Father, and Son are considered by the faithful, quote, the faithful. They're treated as facts. But Father and Son are symbols or metaphors. They are images. They're not facts. And the ordinary Christian does not know that.
Well,
it's a distinction. Fact and image are two different concepts. And I suppose that's such an abstraction that some people really don't understand the difference, huh?
I mean, when you consider how few Christians actually know, what they know about their own religion, that doesn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah.
Well, Jeanette, I'm sorry to have to cut this very interesting conversation, cut it to a close here, but I see my other guest is on the line. But so before we go, let's make sure we mention your book and your blog site again, because you constantly come up with these great blog entries. Listeners, I highly recommend her book, God Is Not Three Guys in the Sky. Jeanette, go ahead and give the, how to reach you in your blog.
Okay. Now, online, it also helps to think of, use the full writer's name, Jeanette Blonigan Clancy. And if you type just Jeanette Blonigan Clancy in, you'll get to my post, too. Or godisnotthreeguys.com, and you can read about my book. I have excerpts from the book. You can get a pretty good idea of the whole message. And you'll find the blog there, too, at godisnotthreeguys.com. Or just type in Jeanette Blonigan Clancy, one N, two T's, and then Blonigan. Spell it the way it sounds, and you'll find it, I think.
Well, and if listeners, if you have any problems, just email me. I will definitely put you in touch with Jeanette. She's definitely worth reading. So, Jeanette, thank you so much for sharing this, this hour with me, talking about the harmful effects of this sexist God talk. And I hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday. And thank you for fighting the good fight from within.
It's always a pleasure, Karen. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, you know that sound. Those chimes mean we are crossing the threshold in the second part of the show. Also, please remember the two F's. What's the two F's, you might ask? Well, the first F is the follow button. Remember, please, to click the follow button on my show page so you automatically get news of who's on the show each week without having to rely on getting a reminder email from me. or a Facebook notice. And please, I invite you to click on the friend button, too. That's the other F, and become a friend of the show. And you will be part of the International Voices of the Sacred Feminine family. You also can catch any show from the archives. You don't have to listen live. And you can also get this show on iTunes as well. And we're going to get to Glenn in just a minute here. I have to ask him for his patience for just a minute. And our topic with Glenn is Mysteries of the Ancient Path, of the Ancient Past. As I said at the top of the show, we're going to be exploring the evolution of human consciousness, civilization, and technology. But I want to tell you first that next week we have on the show, on Thursday night, we have Delphine Damore with us. We're going to be discussing women's empowerment in the 21st century, followed by our beloved and our fan favorite, David Hillman, discussing how contemporary people misunderstand the gods and how their relationship with the gods is different than people in ancient times. He's always a listener favorite, always provocative, our David is. And I just want to make sure you didn't miss some great shows that we had recently. We had Selena Fox talking about the pagan roots of the holidays, Pastor Stacy Bourne from Feminist Her Church in San Francisco was telling us about the Goddess Mural project there, Genevieve Vaughn about the gift economy, Catherine Ravenwood, how to create sacred water, Hannah Rosen, the end of men and women's rise to economic freedom, and of course she meant the end of male dominance, Lorelei Black discussing models of initiation and priestessing and key memoirs of a priestess and contemporary roles of priestesses, Lane Redman discussing Dreaming Awake the Gods and Goddesses of Brazil, and Meredith Smith, Dream Workers Behind the Veil, Night Shift Dreams. All interesting stuff that I think you like by the stats that I see. The show is actually growing by leaps and bounds. So without further delay, I want to say hello to Glenn and welcome him to the show. Hey, Glenn.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you so much for, you know, sharing the next hour with us tonight. I think my listeners are really going to be interested in what you have to say about, you know, ancient wisdom. And, you know, we love to uncover hidden things here, especially things that people don't want us to know.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Oh, no problem. Glenn, let me talk talk first a little bit about your bio here, just so listeners have a little bit of a sense of who you are, and then we'll jump right into our talking points. So, listeners, Glenn Kreisberg. Glenn, am I pronouncing your last name right? Is it Kreisberg or Kreisberg?
Kreisberg.
Kreisberg. He's a radio frequency engineer, outdoor guide, writer, and researcher who currently serves as VP of the New England Antiquities Research Association. He researched and published articles and interviews on historic bluestone quarrying in upstate New York, lithic sites and alignments in the Northeast U.S., and electromagnetism and the ancients, among others. He's the founder and editor of the Alternative Science and History website, ashnews.org, as well as the current editor of the Author of the Month page featured at grahamhancock.com. His first book, an edited anthology of essays titled Lost Knowledge of the Ancients, a Graham Hancock Reader, was published in 2010 by Inner Traditions. His second anthology, The Mysteries of the Ancient Past, is due out this fall, but that's what we're talking about tonight. So we're sort of a little bit past the fall. Is the book actually available now, Glenn?
Yes, Karen, it came out in mid-October, so it is
okay.
Available through Amazon or through Inner Traditions or any other fine bookstore.
Okay, great. Well, so let's start at the top. I mean, you know, the typical question. You know, it seems like you're also into alternative histories and uncovering hidden histories with, you know, with this background from your bio. Has that always been something that's inspired you, Glenn?
Well, it has. You know, I was lucky enough as a teenager to work in an antiquarian bookstore. a good friend of mine, Sam Wenger, owned a bookstore in upstate New York where I live called Three Geese in Flight. And Sam is an authority on Celtic mythology and Arthurian legend and basically ancient mythology and lost civilizations. And I read a lot of these types of books as a teenager and into my young adulthood. So that really helped build my knowledge base for, you know, some of the things that I'm researching and studying at this point.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. It sort of shaped your interests for the rest of your life. That's understandable. So why don't we just start with how you see modern science is actually in alignment with ancient wisdom?
Well, a lot of the researchers that have published books and that have articles that are featured in my anthologies are researchers who are looking into that question. And they're finding that many of the most ancient cultures, if you study the symbolism, if you study the architecture and engineering, if you study what they wrote and inscribed, a lot of it reveals that they had a greater knowledge of technology, a greater knowledge of astronomy, even some quantum physics was understood at a level that we're only beginning to understand today. So it's really quite puzzling to find evidence of particle physics, of quantum physics, referred to in some of the ancient texts of the Vedic cultures or the Middle Eastern cultures of Sumeria. And, you know, it really is a question of interpretation, and a lot of times these ancient cultures didn't have the scientific or technological terminology to describe what they were observing in nature and in the universe. So instead, you find a lot of symbolism and a lot of allegory in this text, in these ancient texts and inscriptions and architectural features that need to be deciphered and understood. And whereas for many thousands of years, a lot of this has not been understood, it appears that in our current time, we're beginning to get a better understanding of what the ancients had in mind as far as their world view and what they in fact knew.
So let me ask you, Glenn, do you fall into the category of researchers or scholars that believe that, you know, maybe ancient man was just really a whole lot smarter than we think, you know, because so much has been lost, so much knowledge has been lost? Or do you fall into the category that we had to maybe have had some sort of, I guess, extraterrestrial help?
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think that the ancient human character was certainly much different than the current character, and there may be physiological answers to why that's so. And you mentioned that the ancient man may have been smarter. And if we go back into an ancient part of history where all humans were preliterate, let's say, before we had written language and certainly humans existed for many thousands of years in that state, a different part of your brain would be more highly developed, the part that was responsible for memory, for things that we don't have to, I mean, we take for granted being able to write something down and read it and retain it or refer back to it for reference. That wasn't the case with the ancient Vedic scriptures and the chants that were repeated for thousands of years before they were written down around 1500 BC. So just the mental capacity was developed in a different way. And there's also some very interesting research going on about electromagnetic fields in the universe and how they may change over time on the solar system, in our solar system. We may, at different periods, be exposed to different levels of electromagnetic radiation, which also may have a physiological effect on our brain. And if we look at some of this, some of the ancient Vedic scriptures and some of the cultures such as the Mayan that refer to these vast cycles of time that take place. Many times they're related or correlate with ages, what might be considered a golden age or a silver age or a iron age or even an age of dirt. And these cycles take place perhaps over thousands and thousands of years. The Vedic cycle is tied, or the Yugas, as they're known, is tied to the precession of the equinox, which is a 26,000-year cycle. And their scripture actually talks about how consciousness changes and the nature of man and the nature of civilization changes and rises and falls with this cycle of precession. So I find it all very fascinating, and there are a lot of researchers who are writing on this, and I've tried to bring them all together in these anthologies.
So let me just try to decipher what I think you just said. So you're saying then maybe humankind has been around a lot longer than we think, first of all?
Well, I don't know that that's so much disputed. I mean, there are some researchers who believe that the human species is far older than is documented in the record. But I don't think, say humans in the current physiological form have been around for 100,000 years. We've only really had art and religion and higher levels of thinking in the last, 20,000 years. So what was going on for that other 80,000 years is hard to say. But certainly once the light switch was turned on, say 30,000 years ago, and we start finding the cave paintings and we start finding evidence of shamanistic culture beginning to develop among the Neanderthal and later early Homo sapiens, we see changes that occur in our society that are not, and in our consciousness, that are not accounted for in any physiological change. Our bodies, our brains are the same, but we've developed them in different ways. And this kind of leads me to a discussion about meditation, because I think meditation is certainly a way that we can higher our consciousness at this period of time, but there may have been a period of time thousands of years ago and perhaps thousands of years from now when what we, the state of higher consciousness that we attain when we meditate, we are in that state more permanently in a different era.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. So you're not necessarily saying that, there were civilizations older than we can imagine, just that we were maybe functioning differently because of, you said, like maybe the electromagnetic fields or different parts of our brain were more stimulated than now. But do you think there was a period of time when humankind was more intelligent than we are today?
I think there was a period of time when we were in more of a higher state of consciousness. It almost goes back to the discussion you were having with your previous guest. I think there was a time when our culture was much more in balance, when we had more of a balance between male and female, where it was probably a matriarchal dominated society, as far as we weren't so hung up on material things as we are in our current culture. And I think that's very much driven by the male aspect of society. But I do think there was a time when we did have a higher consciousness, an intelligence that was applied in a different way than we apply it today. I mean, certainly we have a lot of brilliant people and brilliant breakthroughs that are taking place in our modern culture. There's no question about that. But how the ancients behaved and what they knew, I think, is as important as the kind of breakthroughs that we're learning today. If we can understand how they saw these things and apply that to how we think and behave today, we're going to have a better world for it.
I love examples. Do any come to mind, for instance, that would Well, first of all, you know, where we can see how modern science is aligning with ancient wisdom, or examples of what you just described.
Well, I think the resurgence of shamanism is an example. We see shamanism taking root. There's a resurgence of it. There are several articles that speak to this in my book. So there is a resurgence of elemental shamanism around the world, and why is that happening? What are the lessons that we can learn? And I think it's really fascinating because 500 years ago, of course, the Western world, Western society was sending out missionaries to save the so-called savages in these indigenous and these shamanistic societies, and you know we didn't save them. In fact, our mission was the missionaries, they were supposed to save them, but of course the Western culture threatened them and almost wiped them out. But I think it's very interesting now that the resurgence is taking place. People are beginning to understand the message that shamanistic culture has for today, just a lifestyle, a more of an indigenous lifestyle.
Well, maybe what you're talking about too is, you know, we talk about the web of life, you know, that we're all interconnected. You know, that's that sort of thing, you know, that, you know, the finding the sacred in everything, you know, that whole concept that was, I think, so prevalent to indigenous peoples, you know, that's sort of been lost, you know.
I would say that when a culture has a person, a shaman, who is able to communicate through the veil, to the other side with the spirits, and get information that is beneficial and healing to the society and even to the individual, that can't be ignored, and it's very powerful, and we you know, we haven't really harnessed that in our society. We have great modern medicine and great modern technology, but we're still in need of salvation, and the salvation I think would come from learning from ancient cultures and learning from indigenous groups how they interact, how they behave as a community, the interconnectedness, which is really what we're missing.
Right. It makes me think even about medicine. You know, in our Western culture, we sort of, you know, poo-poo, you know, Eastern modalities and things, and, you know, where it's really a more holistic approach in a lot of cases than the Western approach to healing, is just an example.
And the Western doctors are learning from that, and they're realizing to really serve their patients best, they have to incorporate that holistic approach into their modern approach. And imagine if we imagine how long we would live if we took all the modern technology that's connected to the pharmaceutical and the medical and the healthcare industry. And you know, certainly that you got to give that a lot of credit for giving us long lives and healthy lives and healthier lives. But if we could then superimpose upon that an indigenous lifestyle of spending more time outdoors than indoors and eating nothing but whole foods instead of processed foods and getting involved in group meditation or chanting or singing, we'd live to be 120. You know, it would change us.
Yeah.
In a way that fundamentally would improve ourselves, our personal lives, and our society.
Well, it's sort of like we've been living in our lower chakras, you know, and so many people just sort of stay stuck there, and they never, you know, sort of evolve, I guess, is the simplest way to put it. But things like that, if those were more valued across the board in society, it would uplift, you know, sort of rise all boats, so to speak, I guess.
Well, there are some believe that without that kind of spiritual nurturing, we cease to evolve. I don't know if you're familiar with Gurdjieff?
No.
He was one of the world's great spiritual teachers, and he was said to have searched the world for many years to find a source of esoteric teaching. And he was said to have finally found that in Afghanistan, in a school or a secret brotherhood that was called the Sarman Dark, and Sarman Dark translates roughly to beehive or were collectors of honey. And the school existed to gather up and preserve certain kinds of ancient knowledge regarding the human soul. So, and it's, you know, it's said that thousands of years ago, many of these kinds of monasteries and schools existed throughout the world and served a similar purpose. And in times when that type of knowledge, the esoteric knowledge, was dissipating, and you could say, if you look at these vast cycles of time, we're really at the low end.
Yeah.
We are just coming out of the darkest of ages. And, you know, the great civilizations before Christ, the Greeks and the Egyptians, they all went from a higher state earlier to a lower state later in their existence, in their period. So why did they de-evolve? Why didn't they continue to evolve but de-evolve? Because they were on the wrong side of the cycle of I guess you call it the cycle of consciousness. The Vedics, the East Indians would call it the Vedic cycle or the Yuga cycle. And there were six yugas, three rising and three falling. And they had three rising over 12,000 years and then three descending. And each was a different age and had a different character. And the age we're in now is described as a very shallow, material, superficial age. But
gee, you don't get any disputes from me there.
Yeah, I mean, it fits perfect. You know, you can't argue with it. But the other age at the other end of the cycle is considered a golden age, where there is understanding and peace and harmony among all. Of course, that's a beautiful thing to aspire to as a culture and a society, and it's nice to believe that there is something like that that is attainable. But of course, in the world we live in today, it seems it seems so improbable. But if we think about this knowledge that's out there, this important knowledge, and how it needs to be gathered up like honey and saved, so when we need it most, when it's dissipating, these as Gurdjieff found, these schools served an important purpose, because without the preservation of this knowledge and its continued reintegration into the human spirit, we would cease to evolve. And so that's why it is so important to kind of seek the truth and try to discover what's out there and get it out there for people to know.
Let me just go back a minute. If you could say more clearly, or because sometimes it sounds like maybe you're getting a little farther from the phone, and I'm having a little bit trouble hearing you. So if you could maybe just try to speak up a little bit. What was the name of this group in Afghanistan that was gathering the esoteric knowledge?
It's referred to as the Sarmoun Dark, Sarmoun, and the second word is Dark.
Okay.
There may be various spellings of that.
Well, and just wait, and one other question before you go on. You said that, you know, we sort of have this ebb and flow of enlightenment, so to speak, and we're sort of on the low end right now. How much longer before we move out of that?
Well, it's a slow cycle. As I mentioned, it's tied to the precession of the equinox, which is what the zodiac is based on. I'm not sure if you're aware of what precession is and how that movement. It's kind of like the slowest hand on the clock, astronomically speaking. So the place where the Earth's axis points to in the sky, celestial north, is not a fixed point. It traces a circle. And that circle takes 26,000 years to complete. And that's because as we spin on our axis, we're not spinning perfectly, but we have a slight wobble. And that wobble, if you take a pen and you start spinning it and you give it a little bit of wobble, that's the Earth's axis. And it's creating this circle where the axis of the Earth is pointing to, where celestial north is. And, of course, on the horizon, the way that is manifested is we observe what's known as the precession of the equinox, where the position of the sun rising on the horizon moves about 1 degree every 72 years in relation to the constellations. So as that movement takes place, we move through the constellations. 12,000 years ago, we were in the age of Leo. We passed into the age of Aries. We worked our way through the zodiac. Now we're approaching the age of Aquarius. So these cycles tied to precession have different characters and different characteristics associated with them. Anybody who is familiar with the with astrology knows that based on these different signs and the positions of the moons and the stars, you're going to have a different personality and so on. But what's so interesting about precession is it's the astronomical connection to astrology. So a lot of people say, oh, astrology has no connection to astronomy. In fact, it does, because the zodiacal signs are based on the movement of, that we observe as the precession of the equinox. Now, the precession of the equinox, the Newtonian model for what causes that is the gravity of the moon and the sun is tugging on the earth and causing that wobble. But there is a second astronomical possibility for what causes what we observe as precession. And that second possibility is that the sun is not a singular star, but is in fact a binary star. And there is, again, a building, there's a case building of evidence that the sun may in fact be a binary. Most stars in our galaxy, as high as 80% of them, are binary stars. So what would that mean if the sun was a binary? And people say, well, if it was a binary star, wouldn't we know it? Not necessarily. And if you were to press an astronomer on whether or not the sun is a singular or a binary star, they would say, as far as we know, it's singular, but they would not rule out the possibility that we might have a binary relationship with the sun and another star. Could be a brown dwarf, could be a red dwarf, could be a star that's has a long period cycle, a million years or 26,000 years.
But what does that actually, extrapolated out, what does that actually mean?
Well, what that means is that if the sun did have a relationship with another star and they shared a point of gravity somewhere in the universe, in our galaxy, the Earth would and solar system would be arcing through space in an orbit around this gravitational point in relationship to another body. And as we would move closer and further away from this other star that our star has a relationship with, it could affect our consciousness over a great period of time, having to do, again, with the electromagnetic forces that are ambient in the space that we are traveling. So it's possible, and there are actually research institutes that are out there looking for the binary partner of the sun. In California, there is the Binary Research Institute, which is basically an archaeoastronomy think tank in California. They have a conference once a year called CPAC, the Conference on Precession and Ancient Knowledge, where they present their latest findings and evidence showing that the Earth may, the sun may in fact be a binary. There's also another group in Germany that is working on this. And they have identified Sirius, the brightest star in the sky, as a potential binary for the sun. Now, again, if we were in this relationship, and what's so fascinating about this is if you go back and study the ancient cultures, the most ancient cultures, even pre-literate cultures, they were all very much preoccupied with the precession of the equinox, and many of them mentioned in symbolism, in allegory, the sun having a binary partner. This is explored extensively in a book called Hamlet's Mill, an essay investigating the transmission of knowledge through time by Giorgio de Santalini and Herther von Deutschen. They were both MIT scholars, and this book was published in 1969. And they meticulously researched ancient cultures and really showed how many of them had this mythology of two stars, and how many of these cultures were aware of the precession of the equinox and the relationship between the Earth's axis and the constellations, and how this was very paramount to their understanding of worldview, and how if there was ever any disturbance in this relationship, it always portended disaster. So it's interesting to contemplate. There again is another little book deck was published in 1894 by a swami, an Indian swami named Sri Swami Yukteswar. And Yukteswar wrote this book called The Holy Science, where he referred to the ancient Vedic scriptures and referred, again, in 1894, to the sun having a binary star and having a long period relationship with it that related to the yuga cycles in Vedic scriptures, and showed how each age had a different consciousness and a different characteristic to it. And the further along we get in this cycle, the higher in consciousness and the closer to a golden age we come, until we hit the zenith and then start back down. So whereas we're very used to a linear perception of evolution, it may be that there's another cycle, there's a cycle superimposed on that that also affects our evolution and consciousness.
Okay. Kind of complicated stuff hearing it the first time, but and so forgive me if you've sort of answered this, but I was sort of listening for the yuga, I think you're calling it the yuga cycle that we're entering in of Aquarius now. You know, how does that sort of stack up on the, you know, the three high and the three low? I mean, is that one of the higher levels? I mean, are we getting to the point where we're achieving this higher consciousness, or is it just stuff we sing about in fifth dimension songs?
It's the latter. We are, like I said, we are coming out of the lowest of cycles, which is called the Kali Yuga. It lasts for about a thousand years, and it was centered around 500, our dark ages, 500, the year 500, you know, about 1,500 years ago. Things were pretty bad. That was really the darkest point, and that coincides with the yuga cycles of the Kali Yuga. And then as you begin to ascend, and we are in our present day at the beginning of what's known as the Dwapara or Dwapara Yuga, which lasts from basically the year 1700 or our Renaissance up through about the year 4100. Where we would enter into what's known as the Treta Yuga. And what's at least what's a little bit comforting is that the darkest cycles are the shortest, or the darkest periods in the cycle are the shortest, and then the so-called Silver Age, or the Tetra Yuga, goes from, according to the Vedic cycle, about 4100 current era up until about 7700. And then the Satya Yuga goes from about 7700 up until the year 12,500 in the future. That's the highest.
We have a long way to go. We are in our infancy then.
Yes, that's very true. And that's why our culture is kind of stuck where it is. But we are ascending, and of course if we can speed this up through our knowledge, through our practices, through meditation, we can get to a place where perhaps, you know, more of our society will be in a permanent state at some point down the road a ways, but it is a ways.
Okay. Well, let's shift gears a little bit here. We were going to also talk about common themes and symbols of ancient mythology that reveal an esoteric or pagan link with the Abrahamic religions.
Sure. Well, it ties right in with what we were talking about, because if we look at these many pre-Christian cultures going back thousands of years before Christ, including the cultures in China, in Persia, in the Middle East, in Far East, in Asia, I'm sorry, I'm just shuffling some papers here. Bear with me. Refresh me on what you wanted to go down, what road we're going down now.
We were going to talk about the themes and symbols of ancient mythology that point to that esoteric or pagan link with Christian and Judean beliefs.
Yeah, so let's talk about the symbols of the tree of life and the serpent, for example. We are all familiar with the Christian symbols of the tree of life with the serpent wrapped around it, and in many regards, the Christian view of the serpent is quite negative. In the biblical mythology, the snake has a pretty bad reputation. But there are, again, in these ancient cultures, these symbols have different meanings. And we see the tree of life and we see the serpent portrayed in other cultures, as I mentioned, pre-Christian, that that have different significance. And as I was mentioning about the procession of the equinox and the axis of the earth, there are many interpretations of the tree of life and the serpent where the tree is the axis of the earth, and the serpent is in fact the constellation Draco, which is the serpent or snake constellation, which is circumpolar and is always found spinning around the point of celestial north, where that tree of life or where that axis points to in the sky. And again, this is tied to the procession, that so-called wobble that makes the sunrise and sunset on the solstice and equinox change and move through the constellations over the many thousands of years. So this is why, if there is a change in that relationship or a change in the Earth's axis, it usually meant terrible disasters would occur on the Earth. And we see also tied to Christian mythology in the pre-Christian times, this character, the Christ character, the hero character, and many of the Christian stories and biblical stories we find of resurrection, of destruction, of a great flood. All these are you know, by the time they end up in the Bible, they're thousands of years old. These Sumerians in the Epic of Gilgamesh. The story of the flood. I mean, this was all symbolism that was well entrenched in many other cultures and was kind of brought back or regurgitated in a new form for Christian consumption, I should say.
So let me ask you, these symbols, like for instance, you said the Great Flood was a symbol. What was it a symbol of? Because you're obviously alluding to the fact that maybe there wasn't a literal flood.
No, I don't think I said that it was a symbol, because I think the mention of these things in ancient cultures were quite revealing as to what took place. They are a record of a great flood, maybe periodic floods that took place thousands of years ago. Earlier, you kind of said that I discounted lost or ancient cultures. I think there is a great period of time that we don't know anything about. I think there probably was advanced civilization prior to the end of the last ice age. Again, going back about 12,000 years to where we may have been at the high point of a cycle, there's a very interesting book that just came out by Robert Schock. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He's the geophysicist and geologist from Boston University who redated the Sphinx and put it much earlier than has been credited.
Oh, isn't he the one that said that the lines were really erosion, water erosion?
Exactly. He was the first geologist to go there and look at it and say, you know, the geology doesn't fit the time. It was eroded in a period when there was much greater rainfall in Egypt, and that had to be prior to about 5,000 BC, about 7,000 years ago. So, of course, the pyramids and the Sphinx are credited with being built around 2,500 BC or 5,000 years ago. So here's a scientist saying, no, you know, what we're reading in the textbooks is off by thousands of years, and that the Sphinx is actually at least 7,000, and he believes actually quite older.
Right.
And there's a lot of evidence as well that it may have been, you know, the head was recarved, and it may have been quite a bit older than what the Egyptologists now currently say it is. And, you know, again, it just points to that there are eras of the past, eras that we just are not aware of yet. I think many of the breakthroughs in archaeology that are going to take place in the 21st century are going to take place underwater. Under sea archaeology, Robert Schock's latest book is called Lost Civilization, and he believes that there was a mass corona ejection from the sun that ended the last ice age very rapidly, melted the glaciers, raised the sea levels 300 feet, about 100 meters, in an extremely short period of time, and that any coastal civilization, any evidence of that prior to 10,000 years ago, 10,000 BC, would be wiped away, you know, would not be, would just simply would not be accessible for archaeologists to go and research.
Right, yeah, it would be lost. Well, no, that, well, and, well, you know, going back to the Sphinx, you know, I mean, I've always thought that, you know, if people were going to create this grand monument, it wouldn't be so, you know, off in, you know, the head is too small, you know, for the whole body. I mean, it's, to me, it so obviously was recarved. Well, are there other places that that he points to besides, you know, that we can see, you know, that aren't underwater besides the Sphinx that may, you know, have a different history than, you know, academia accepts as, you know, is real historical fact?
Well, if any of your listeners are into archaeology, they'll know the name Göbekli Tepe.
Oh, yeah, in Turkey, absolutely.
Yes. That's exactly the site that speaks to what you just asked, because that is kind of the missing link of ancient civilization. The problem with the Egyptian civilization is it appeared almost fully formed without much of a developmental period, and that's always been a puzzle. And people say, well, there must have been some proto-culture that they built from, but where was it? And of course, if Schock says the evidence of geology points to the Sphinx being 7,000 years old, people will say, okay, well, that's one piece of evidence, but where's the
rest? Can you come back to the phone? Glenn, come back to the phone. You're getting further away.
Okay, no, I'm trying to stay right close to it.
Okay.
The academics would say, okay, where's the rest of the evidence to prove that there was an older culture that the Egyptians may have been based on? And this Göbekli Tepe site in Turkey is in some regards the smoking gun, because it shows that there was a high state of culture, a very high sophisticated belief system developed and in place that built this site, and that was not previously known. And it's so much older than the pyramids, and it is so much mystery to it, and there's so many fabulous architectural discoveries that are being associated with it, as far as carvings of relief of different animals and combinations of humans and animals. And
right there, there was a sacred display object or a Shilin Agid there too that you know, they don't always talk about. I know for a while I knew some women who went there and they were actually hiding it in the archaeologist's shed or something, but. Well, now, one of the things about that site, I believe I read, was that it looked like it was purposefully covered. Is that what you heard, too, and was there? Do we know why?
In Schock's book, he talks about how the site looks like it was developed around 11,000 years ago and how it appears to have been intentionally buried about 8,000 years ago and had been in use for 3,000 or 4,000 years. Why it was buried, and it does, the evidence does seem to think that the show indicate that it was intentionally buried, that's a great mystery. But what's been speculated is that it was some type of time capsule intended to be preserved and rediscovered at a later date with an important message to be gleaned from it. And a lot of people believe this is also the purpose of the pyramids, the Great Pyramids of Giza, that there is important messages to be learned from studying the architecture and the measurements and the relationships between the measurements and their relationships to the planet, actually, and the size of the planet and the planet's position in the solar system. There are researchers who believe all of that is encoded within the pyramids, within the architectural layout of the plateau and where the monuments are located. Some think it's a processional clock showing when a natural disaster may occur, may have once occurred, may occur again. So there's a lot more to these ancient sites than we realize, when we're just beginning to find out the full potential of what they have to teach us.
Well, and what concerns me, Glenn, I don't know if it does you, if we talk about academia, you know, they're so narrow-minded in their thinking, and they don't ever want to rethink things when new evidence is presented with them. It makes me think that, you know, great discoveries may come down the pike, and, you know, some guy's ego is going to prevent us from learning the real history. We hear every day how, you know, archaeologists find things that don't fit the accepted timeline or historical view of a place, and it just, you know, this person never gets funded again, or they, their discoveries never get published, and, you know, that's disturbing.
It is, and that's why I've kind of gone out of my way to find researchers who have done really solid research that presents compelling evidence of a different paradigm, of an alternative view. And you're right, they are scarcely given credit by the academics. But time shakes things out. You know, 500 years from now, 200 years from now, people may be reading about how they, you know, discovered that the pyramids were laid out to match the belt of Orion. And, you know, that may just be common knowledge, whereas now, you know, people don't realize that or realize the importance of it, or if it is realized, it's viewed skeptically it's kind of a so what approach by academics. But I think part of going through these cycles and being on the ascending side, and this kind of speaks a little bit to what's going to happen tomorrow on the 21st, the Mayan prophecies, which I guess we should talk about for a moment because it's right here upon us.
Sure, yeah, go right ahead. I almost purposefully avoided it because I thought it might just be, that again. But no,
right,
come
well,
on, let's. I'm interested to see what you have to say about it because, you know, who knows?
Well, I don't think the world's going to end tomorrow. It's a bit of a red herring. What you have to understand about Mayan mythology and the ancient Mayan cultures is that they were tremendous astronomers. Calendars were very important to them, where if we have one calendar, they had 20, 30 calendars. And their kings and their leaders were brilliant at using astronomy and using calendars to mark auspicious occasions and to secure their power and to be viewed as very, very well for many years. So, you know, there was one particular 7th century king whose name translates roughly to something like the Jaguar King. They couldn't pronounce it in Mayan, but he created a new calendar, and that calendar consisted of taking the long count calendar, which had already been around for over 1,000 years, and he simply said, we're going to take a new calendar and we're going to put my name on it, and we're going to project my birth date on that calendar forward to the end of the long count calendar until tomorrow. And so he did this to keep his name alive. He did this so people would continue to talk about and remember him. And in a way, it kind of worked because we're still talking about that date. And that date is really only appears in two places. It appears on the Dresden Codex, which is in Dresden, Germany, and that's a book, one of the only books that survived the conquistadors. The Mayans had libraries. They had thousands of books, written language, and most of that was destroyed. But one book called the Dresden Codex remained, and it has a reference to the long count calendar and the ending date of December 21st, 2012. And then it's also that date is mentioned one other place, and that's on a stele, a stone inscription that this king had commissioned in the 600, in the year 6-something, the 7th century. And basically it's just a calendar that has his name projected forward to the end of time, the end of the long count calendar. So it's a bit of a red herring, but we have to also remember that their society and their culture, which was based on cycles of time, called the Khatuns and the Bakhtuns, which were these 450 and these 1,400-year periods, that added up to this long calendar. And the way the Mayans viewed these cycles is when they got to the end of one of these long periods, 1,400 years or 400 years, they would, it really was a time of renewal, a time of transformation for them, because they would make the assumption that all of their beliefs and values and customs that had developed over the hundreds of years had become foul and corrupted, and they would abandon them, and they would abandon their cities and just move to a new place and start fresh. And I think that's very telling. You know, it gives a new perspective. I mean, we could say our society has gotten stale, and it would be wonderful if we could get rid of all the bad precepts and bad concepts that have taken root and start fresh with only what's good from our culture and abandoning the negative. And that,
maybe there's something to be said that even if there's really, you know, if this the day tomorrow has really just sort of been hyped and there's really nothing to it, but there's so many people that believe that after tomorrow things are going to be different and people's consciousness is going to be uplifted. You know, if our thoughts are really things, you know, maybe we do project ourselves forward a little bit just by our own belief.
It's very powerful what you're just saying. It can't be discounted. And I also want to remind everybody that apocalypse, the word apocalypse in Latin, if you look that up, what it means is an unveiling or an uncovering. And I think what you were saying about the skeptics and about those who are kind of don't buy this and the academics who poo-poo all this, this is a time, and it's because so many people do think it's a fresh and there is a sense of renewal and transformation that's needed. You see these people starting to scratch their head a little. They're starting to, it's almost as if the veil has been pulled back even for them. And they can get a glimpse on the other side, and that there is another reality they have to admit to, even though it doesn't, fit in with their worldview, and they don't have the evidence or the scientific method to back it up. They have to say there is something more. They have to say you can see there's something there. So maybe
we're starting to crack through.
I do believe so, and I think that's again the beginning sign of our ascension into a better age.
Well, Glenn, I think that's probably a positive note to leave on because we're almost out of time. Why don't you go ahead and tell listeners where they can find your book? And, I want to thank you for the interesting conversation and insights tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. The books are available through Amazon. The first one came out, as you mentioned, in 2010, Lost Knowledge of the Ancients. The second one just came out a month or so ago, Mysteries of the Ancient Past. They are both published by Inner Traditions, Bear & Company. You can visit my website, ashnews.org. You can also go to the Graham Hancock website, grahamhancock.com, where you can find out more about these researchers and other researchers who publish articles there that are really fascinating and eye-opening and offer, fresh ideas for people who want to have an open mind and want to consider things other than what they already know.
Well, it sure keeps life interesting, doesn't it?
It does. It certainly does.
Well, Glenn, thank you so much, and thank you for being on the show tonight and for having the type of mind that you have, an opened one, and we appreciate what you brought listeners to the show tonight.
Well, thank you, Karen. I appreciate what you do as well, and I hope everybody has a great holiday season and a wonderful new year.
Okay, same to you. Thank you, Glenn. Good night.
Good night.
Well, as we come to a close to tonight's show, I want to share something with you. I think it's in keeping with all we're talking about in terms of change. There was a special screening last night at Olindor in Malibu. Emmanuel Etier, as producer with Wonderland Entertainment, announced that the film Femme, Women Healing the World, a documentary, is scheduled to be released in early 2013. Men and women from around town were invited to view the film. I was there. The film is, the executive producer is Sharon Stone. And as we watched the film, we saw visionaries and scholars were highlighted, people like Jean Shinoda Bolen, Jean Houston, Marianne Williamson, Rhian Eisler, Barbara Marks Hubbard, many of these women who have been on my show, including Marian Robbins Dexter and myself. I actually have a little part in it as well. FEM, you know, has been in the works for the past 3 years. The producer, Emanuele Etier, has been traveling around the world interviewing women across the globe to get their feedback on the state of the world and what we can do about saving the planet and life as we know it. Well, the consensus is it's time for women and men to work together in partnership, using their feminine and masculine attributes to shift the world away from patriarchy. Time for women to step up and claim their mantle of leadership and guide the way toward a world of caring economics that benefits everyone on the planet, not just men or a select group of elites. It was really a daring undertaking that this producer embarked upon, I believe. The film starts at the beginning telling us about goddess cultures and the loss of the sacred feminine and moves forward to show what diminishing women and the rise of capitalism and patriarchy has done to the female gender and the planet. I really recommend you go to WonderlandEntertainmentGroup.com. You can see trailers for the movie Femme, and you will be hearing more about that in the coming weeks and months from me. I've said this the last couple shows. I'd like to say it again, remind you of Dr. Emmanuel Bronner's quote, that constructive capitalism is where you share the profit with the workers and the earth from which you made it. Certainly different ideology than this predator capitalism we're living in, where we are all prey to the corporatocracy. Remember, too, what Mother Nature teaches us, what you nurture and tend to survives and thrives, what you neglect, well, it just withers on the vine. And please, listeners, keep sending me your stories about this show and what it means to you, your guest suggestions as well. And the show is also looking for a like-minded sponsor, and we do commercials. I want to close with a prayer from the Goddess Temple, which is where I will be tomorrow night taking part in their Yule celebration, their end of an era celebration. Anyway, the prayer from the Goddess Temple goes like this. Great Goddess, how amazing to be alive in this time of momentous change, expectation, and possibility. Each day I embrace my essential place in the cosmos. Each day I put my precious consciousness in service to the greatest good. In this time of winter, the time of the wise woman elder, when humanity needs wise leaders now more than ever, I resolve anew to serve as a wise spiritual leader in all I do. Thank you for the gift of life in this astonishing time in history. Blessed be. Well, good night, my dear friends, fans, family, and colleagues. May Goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Have a wonderful holiday season until next week when we meet again. And I am going to say goodbye with the music by Diva Haley called Sacred Alchemy. You'll get to hear this for a couple minutes before we go off the air. Good night. Thank you for your listener loyalty, and have a great holiday weekend.